Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. Today, I'm pleased to welcome our guest, Jeff Auksher. Jeff is the president of Auksher Asset Management and founder of the Auksher Focus Fund. Prior to forming Auksher Asset Management in 1998, Jeff spent 16 years at Smith Barney, formerly Foster Marshall American Express, then Shearson, where he was on the Portfolio Management Advisory Board and the Chairman's Council. He also served as Senior Vice President of Investments and was a Senior Portfolio Management Director. As always, for those of you out in the audience, please feel free to post your questions and comments in the live chat throughout the presentation, but keep in mind we do like to hold those until the end of things when we can go ahead and jump into them fully during our Q&A. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead and hand things over to Jeff and we can jump into the presentation.
Thanks, Graham. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be with you. I think Guru Focus does an excellent job. I can really relate back in when I first started the business on a smaller scale. I started traveling around the country, identifying great investors. I actually called Warren Buffett on a Saturday in 1982, 3 weeks before the first Forbes 400. And he was very generous, took my calls. So I was kind of hooked and then continued to go, became a shareholder and continued to go to all the meetings or as many meetings as I could. But prior to that, you know, when I was 11, I actually had a lawn business and mowed the lawns of the founding families of Georgia Pacific. So Bob Pamplin, who was CEO from 1956 to 1976, he took $100 to 3,200. So I learned, and then I became kind of a junior bookkeeper under his tutelage. And then when he retired, he became one of the biggest denim producers in the world. So like Warren Buffett says, you know, pick your heroes carefully. So I was kind of hooked on that approach from the very beginning because that aversion to loss and the power of compounding, and it's really served our clients well. Again, we've really focused on being better business analysts. We're not really market analysts. So we look at cumulative knowledge and the power of compounding. Those are our two focus. We use cumulative knowledge to mitigate risk, to keep high compounded returns. And we have companies, you know, I've held since 82, 83, 84, a lot of the positions we try to defer compound at high rates of return. But still we found over the decades, there's no substitute for incredibly hard, dedicated research. So this year we've hit more CEOs than any year in my career. And we're up over 60. So we think that's so critical, having the humility to do the work, to not rest on your laurels. We started our firm, we have roughly $800 million in assets. In 1998, I was in a stock picking contest with Money Magazine nationally, and we won that consecutively. So then that led to a flood of business, but we set up the firm in 98. And we set up our fund, the Auksher Focus Fund, right at the top of the market in 1999. And if you told me the next 10 years, we would see 240% declines, I probably would have thought, you know, differently, but I put 100% of my retirement into the fund. I've locked that in. And currently, I can't sell a share. And so we feel like, you know, eating your own cooking is incredibly important, you know, sharing the downside. And so our firm has been very conservative, debt-free. And we just, again, have followed these Buffett principles, and have been shareholders with Mr. Buffett for you know, since the 80s. What I'm probably most proud about is from 1999 to 2009, when the market declined by roughly, I think the market was down about 4 or 5%. We were up 83%. So our best years of outperformance were that 10 years where we had 240% declines. And also in 1999, we were, we invested with Benchmark in a company called eBay. So we kind of seen that side of startup businesses. I was on the board for several years. And so we successfully sold that to Samsung, but we've been exposed to the startup. Going back to 1999, this is very similar. We're seeing a lot of the same kind of behavior as we did in 99. The difference back then is when rates started moving up, that was kind of the beginning of the end. So we haven't seen Fed tightening yet, but the crazy behavior, which we sat out, obviously, we were actually net up those 3 years when the market dropped. But back then, Intel was just a rocket. We had a lot of Intel top execs, and one was actually developed a 386 chip. And, you know, Intel, you couldn't beat Intel from 94 to 2000. And even in 2000, the numbers were off the charts. But, you know, stock hit 75. You know, today the stocks, you know, are about 50. So that's 21 years, you know. Microsoft was doing fantastic. From 99 to 2009, it dropped, you know, almost 50%. So I was taught early on to price the portfolio. Bob Pamplin, in my teens, I was pricing their portfolio daily by hand. So that's a good lesson for all your listeners. pricing the portfolio by hand, I can tell you by year what we've done. And that's a real important thing because you want to understand where we are in the cycles. Easy money, Wall Street tends to get very excited and they tend to overproduce. I'll never forget going to the Berkshire Hathaway meetings, and level three was back in 99 was just sizzling hot. They were backed by Kiewit. They were laying fiber optic. Like it was the biggest boom, one of the biggest I've seen. And we were basically just people were, it was Berkshire and level three. So level three hit 175. So the next year, I believe the stock dropped to five because what happened back then, everyone was connecting to the internet hosting and then fiber optic. Well, you had almost 400 IPOs go public and almost that many failed. So we've seen these before back in 1720, Isaac Newton was supposedly the smartest human on earth. And then he went into the South Sea Trading Company, one of the first SPACs, you know, and everyone said, well, he's really smart, guy like Elon Musk. Well, we better just give him his money and forget about it. Well, it, you know, that company soared from, you know, under 100 pounds to 1,000 pounds. And then it ultimately crashed and burned. And back in the 1920s, we had RCA, and it was like the most owned stock, and it dropped from 102 to 2 from 1929 to 32. And all the new technologies get everyone excited. You know, we had 2,000 auto manufacturers, you know, from 1900 to 1930. We had all of the new technology with the airlines, et cetera. But you know, with all that, the number one performing group in a dollar invested in tobacco in 1900, today is worth $6.3 million. So you don't need all these technologies. You know, See's Candy, you know, Mr. Buffett bought it, I think, for $28 million. And I think they pulled $1.6 billion out of See's Candy. Same plants, little pricing, very low nominal capex. So we're looking for those business like everyone else, you know, the high return businesses, low capital, low mandatory capex. And the problem is today's market is just, those are all insanely overpriced. And so you either kind of ride the momentum, but in the last, probably the last 8 weeks, what we try to do is we hit as many CEOs as we can in the course of a year to see where the pulse is. About 8 weeks ago, everything just turned dramatically. Prior to that, the highest priced stocks were doing the best. And the cheapest stocks were doing the worst. And then all of a sudden we've seen a huge churn. We're seeing a big change in insurance pricing. We like Aon and Marsh and Travelers. And so we're seeing that turn. So the big thing we try to do is keep on the pulse of these businesses. And it's been a long, like we have a lot of small cap companies we've been meeting with. And there was a company in 2003, First Service. And I met the CFO actually back in 2003, and great, high integrity. They do property management in Canada. You think, wow, well, small company. That stock now has gone from about 2 to 130 in the portfolio. So what we've found is you can do really well on these small businesses. Everybody wants to be in these big name companies. But what we learned back in 2000, it was the Janus 20. Everyone wants to concentrate at the high. 1972, 73, it was the Nifty 50. You know, everyone feels comfortable buying, you know, the same companies. But what we found is just, as I remember, it was IBM in 1985, and, it was AOL. It was a rocket from, 94 to 2000. And it's a lot harder to have more names. So, in that 80s, we were very concentrated. We had 12 stock portfolios. Now we've spread it way out because the insanity of central banks. We're looking at interest rates, according to the history of interest rates, the book, are at 5,000-year lows. You know, we've added $3 trillion plus just in monetary stimulus. And so when you drive rates to zero, you inflate bubbles everywhere, people say, well, it's not a bubble, but every time you get detached from cash flow, you have a lot of downside risk. That's why we have, the fund has outperformed since 1999, the fund's 356 versus 310, but actually our equities are up 600%. 10,000 of the funds worth about 43 versus 37 for the market. But the reason is value. What happens, it's not that these companies, it's not so much value. It's more like momentum bubbles burst, And so back in 2000, you had Cisco and Intel and Microsoft, you had all these companies that were going up, but there was no earnings. And they ultimately all come down. 2 years ago, we saw the marijuana stocks. They were just roaring. Tilray went, from 20 to, I think it was up as high as 300, and it dropped 90%. So without cash flow and earnings, our focus is always on cash flow, earnings, valuation. And our approach has always been the same. The markets can go, they can become crazy, but the key is for investors, investing is a craft that's specific. You don't want to be, crazy on the, in other words, you don't want to join the, Buffett says there's, you can kind of fear greed and folly, but you don't want to participate in the folly. But what we've been doing presently, again, hitting a lot of CEOs, it's been a major digital divide. If you look at, you can't be on the wrong side of digital. If you look at our Donnelly printing companies, newspapers, analog, anything like that. So what we try to do is dig deep in each company, and companies like Yum Brands or McDonald's or Starbucks, they're utilizing digital to, enhance the customer experience. So those we're looking at you look at Facebook and Alphabet, just incredible platform companies that are, the data is the new oil. Again, we've got pretty strong demographic trends, 90 million millennials, they're buying houses, a multiplier effect on the housing market's pretty strong. So you've got overall, most CEOs are just, where inventory levels are really low or rebuilding. So with all the stimulus, it really could, a lot of businesses outside of travel are booming and what have you. So like I say, we're hitting these companies, and the advantage of hitting companies over and over, we had a company called CAE. They're the number one business that trains airline pilots. Obviously it got crushed, but we met with them 3 years in a row. We met with them, 2 months ago, bought the stock, it had dropped to 13 and boom, back to 27. But we had to build that cumulative knowledge. And that cumulative knowledge, like Buffett talks about compound interest and compound knowledge, we're always looking. I was taught they can take all of your money away, but they can't take your knowledge. So we prize the day-to-day grinded out research, you know, in the cumulative knowledge of knowing these businesses. Because when the crash comes, you know, the problem with indexing, like 1989, the Nikkei was 39,000. 20 years later, it was 7,500. Well, when do you buy that index, right? And we want to know, I mean, we go through 1,500 companies a year. We want to know everything about, we want to know who the players, we talk about, you know, trust 1%, verify 99%, you know, talk is extremely cheap. In today's world, everyone with options, you know, the average holding period today, I mean, back in 1990, I think the average holding period was 2 years, and now it's, you know, down to 5 months. So this isn't investing, you know, investing is a craft of the specific people are speculating. And, you know, when you see these prices totally detached, you know, and there just is no, there's no shortcut what investing is all about. Dogged day-to-day grinded out research. And like George Gilder has always said, it's not about money. It's about that cumulative knowledge. So, you know, ideally, you know, someone who's 90, like Warren Buffett, who's about that age, I think, is, you know, a better investor because he's got the cumulative knowledge. So that's kind of what we try to do is stick to the basics and just outwork. Hopefully we outwork everyone. We try. But that voracious research efforts is at the core of what we're doing. And we do like getting into the details. And some of the other lessons, you know, we've just found over time, you know, talk is extremely cheap. There's a really good book for all of your subscribers. It's called Financial Shenanigans. And that book totally has saved us over the years. I know the author really well, Mr. Shillett. And I would urge everyone at this stage of the mania to really read that, because now you're going to start to see a lot of accounting irregularities. And it's really important to know your accounting, because, you know, we identify back when Enron, way back, you know, Enron dropped from 80 to zero, and we met with Enron, we got everybody out of Enron, because we looked at the balance sheet, we looked at the entire business. The other thing is, there's just no shortcuts. You can't just look at a PE, you've got to look at the entire entity, you've got to look at the capital allocation. The big sins we keep seeing are overpaying, overborrowing. And so, you know, these are all lessons I've learned over, you know, since starting and then studying under, you know, studying everything about Buffett over the years. Again, back then, some of the great investors I talked to, Henry Singleton was, I think, one of the very best. John Templeton, his book, The Humble Approach, was really good. Like I say, it's a game of humility, grinded out. Those that are in it for the long haul will be ready. We just want to be armed and ready all the time and wait for that folly. So we think right now we're getting really late in tech. We're getting really early in the ag. For instance, we've watched the ag cycle peak in 2012. Usually the peaks, you see a lot of M&A at crazy prices. When people say price doesn't matter, Chesapeake Energy was that way, and they dropped from 60 to zero, you know. Aubrey McLennan was paying any price for natural gas leases and what have you. So when they say price doesn't matter, you know, it's like when money's easy, grab your wallet and run the other way, you know, the Buffett saying. And so we saw that with $400 billion this year in write-downs in energy. Money was so easy. The shale model is just, it's not profitable, you know. So, and just, you know, models, 1998, long-term capital, we saw that blow up. More PhDs on staff than any firm in the world at the time. So it's a game of humility. Ironically, we started a fund in 1999. Again, the equities are up over 600%. You know, we've only been about, like I say, 79%. GE was the most highly valued company at that time. And GE has dropped over 50% over that same period. So it's not ego, it's actually humility, because big egos, overpaying, overborrowing in exuberance, that's really what we see as the recurring sin to destroying shareholder value. And, you know, talk is cheap. So we prefer to watch and verify, you know, on the numbers all the time and start with the numbers, you know, because the power of compounding is so phenomenal, you know, that those two Buffett rules, first rule, don't lose your capital. Second rule is never violate the first rule. Sounds trite, sounds boring, but it's so critical because if you're down, if you're up 50% year one, up 15 year two and down 15 year three, 8% beats that. If you're down 90, you got to go up 1,000. And back in 01, we saw a lot of companies drop 80 to 90%. I mean, even Amazon dropped from 113, I think, to 6. And so you just have to know what you own because people don't stick with these things. Like Peter Lynch says, the key organ in investing is the stomach, you know. And so, you know, that's the problem with these booms is when they go bust, it takes people out of the game. So what we try to do is just protect on the downside, keep people gradually compounding, you know, and protect on the downside because people won't, like I say, they figure over 90% of Fidelity Magellan holders have lost money. Their best performers were from 2003 to 2013. They said their best performers were the clients that were dead, you know, they didn't have any emotion. Right. So that's what happens. We see this over and over. And that's why Buffett has done so well. He just, in Charlie Munger, they are great because they're rational. They keep their emotion out. Like John Templeton, you know, go off your ledger, keep your emotion out of the equation. And so, you know, these are all things that we found, but going over the decades, like the 80s, we were concentrated in 12 stocks, but you know, the 90s and then now, because things are so crazy with 18 trillion in negative rates, anything can happen with all of the debt. So we have chosen to be much more diversified, you know, but that's, like I say, these are all lessons to help you guys, you know, as far as in what I've learned again, that the power of cumulative knowledge and just, I'm reading a book on the Rothschilds. I mean, how does a family endure for centuries, right? Our outlook is 100 years. We want to run our business for 100 years. If you study Japanese companies, they endure because of their balance sheet. So, you know, there's this, everyone talks about, you know, like the Yale model, no cash, but we've always run cash debt-free, you know, 2 or 3 years in reserves. And it's a good lesson. If you want to endure, like again, back in 99, you had internet companies that were doubling. The funds were doubling. They were out of business in 3 years. You know, again, the Janus 20 was like the hot 20 growth stocks. And they just, they all blew up. You know, back 72, 73, again, Nifty 50. These stocks got up to 80-fold. The idea was, well, we buy and hold these forever. They dropped over 70%, you know. So price does matter, no matter what people say. you know, at some point it will matter. I think it's really changed the last 8 weeks, and we're really encouraged because we can't overpay, or at least you know, I refuse to overpay. Just when you go through the 87 crash and you see over a 20% drop, we always said, Lord, please help me. I promise I'll never overpay ever again in my life. You know, when you see the thrift crisis in 1990 or 91, you saw Wells Fargo drop from 245 to 45. But actually, I worked for the number one thrift manager at that time in the country. Actually, it was a client, and Elliot Knudsen sent me around the country. We actually bought these banks 40 cents on the dollar from 1991 to 98. They were the number one performing group. So but he had the cumulative knowledge. It's like Carlos Slim, his I guess great-great-grandfather came over in 1910, and they taught each of the kids, each generation, the power of the ledger and knowing the businesses, kind of like the Rothschild family. So it's incumbent to know, you know, back to George Gilder, cumulative knowledge. So everyone, I think that's the number one message I would say is don't quit, do more homework, but realize that it doesn't stop. You've got to continue to do it every single day. And so do you want questions now, or do, or I, I've got some other, I was going to talk about companies or, you know.
So we can go ahead and jump into a couple companies now. We do have about 10 or so questions built up now, and they're slowly starting to flow in some more as well. So if we want to hit on, you know, handful of companies real quick and then start jumping into questions, I think that'll work out well.
Okay, thanks, Ram. Yeah, so basically, again, we've written all these CEOs. We found really good value on in the last three months or so in the healthcare names. A lot of the, you know, the United Healths, the Anthems, those prior to the election, they always get hit. And we've been buyers of those, you know, for 30 years, basically. Whenever we've had bad headline news, we originally bought United Health at a 30% free cash flow yield. It was $45 back in 2010. Same with Anthem. They had over 30% free cash flow yield. So the fear in that space has created good opportunities. You know, things like Aflac, 36, 8 times earnings. This is just they dominate, you know, the health supplement market in Japan. But for that stock to be 7 or 8, well, that's now gone from 36 to 45. And, you know, like we talked about, there's a lot of good over the last 8 weeks. You just see a tremendous change in what has been leading all of the bigger name. Even our Microsoft has been kind of flat relatively. Our basis at Microsoft is 20. That's one of our top three for all the clients, you know, but, you know, you're seeing a lot of, the whole marijuana trade. But for instance, Molson Coors, I mean, they're introducing a marijuana drink with the beer, which is probably the best way to approach that. And so, you know, that's the stock we're buying down recently, 34, and it bought the 47. So the good news is value starting to matter more. We still like the Alphabets and the Facebooks, those names that have the platforms and those dominant, you know, data is, like we say, the new oil. And so companies that are utilizing, but we'd rather buy the companies that are, you know, utilizing the technology. I mean, really Nike is more of a technology stock, you know, those Starbucks and what have you. They're more companies utilizing digital. Like we talked about, I remember R. Donnelly, it's been running like a dollar while printing, and all the great newspaper companies. And so you really have to be on the pulse of the digital trend. You know, we are transforming. And I mean, when you look at what's happened with, we met recently with Booking, but you look at Airbnb, you know, to have that stock go to 100 billion value is pretty remarkable since 2009. So we've been with, you know, Sequoia did that. We were with Sequoia in another investment that got bought out by TransUnion. And like I say, we've been with Benchmark and with eBay. So I've seen those models. The problem with the delivery model, and again, I live on a farm and we've got farms and ranches, and actually we have Airbnbs, but the problem with the delivery model is you just, as a farmer, you just don't want to deliver anywhere because it's cheaper to ship to China on the water than to truck from New Jersey to New York. So everyone's all excited about this delivery, but I got to tell you, shipping costs are up 50 to 100%. And so we're with eBags, we were really the number one bag seller in the world. But, you know, people would order 9 bags and then, you know, they'd send back 8, and then we had to take care of those and we had free shipping. And believe me, we were thrilled to sell that to Samsung. I mean, we had a good profit, but it's really important to look at each model and look at the sustainability of the model. We look at pricing. We want pricing. Right now, there's tremendous pricing in insurance. Aon and Marsh are holdings that we have some Aon going all the way back to $2, I think. And then so good pricing because we've taken over $100 billion in hits. And that's going to really benefit Berkshire Hathaway because the pricing, Ajit Jain, he's the best probably in the entire industry. And they can write so much business in a hard market. So we see this as maybe one of the best insurance markets for pricing that I've seen in my lifetime. So that really benefits Berkshire. You've got the best insurance mind in the world with Berkshire. And I don't think people are looking at that Berkshire. I always remember Bill Ruane said, you know, once we have just the worst catastrophes, you know, buy Berkshire because the pricing. So stocks will follow pricing. You look at $1,000 into Philip Morris in 1926 is worth $110 million. Now, why is that pricing? See's Candy, $28 million. You know, they pulled $1.6 billion. Why is that? They priced a little bit. It's same factories. You know, they're not, you know, redoing the factories. Best ingredients, tiny pricing. So pricing's a big deal. And when you have too much supply, obviously, you know, so we're looking at industries that are capital constrained, like insurance, because you've taken out capital, you've got pricing, you're starting to see pricing, you know, lumber and you're, you know, a lot of these commodities are going to be constrained. You know, I can tell you on the watching the farm cycles, you know, we're seeing really starting to pick up recovery. First time, like I say, we had this long 118 month boom commodities. The mergers in 2012, everything exploded. Now Mosaic was 160 back in 2008. It's a fertilizer company. Recently dropped to like 15. Now it's, I think, 23. But that's on the way up, whereas tech, we're getting really late in the game. Too much supply, you know. And Wall Street tends to do that. They get excited. They oversaturate. And then the next cycle, you know. And also, we've also found opportunity parking money or cash in floating rate bank preferreds. When the banks were constrained, they can't buy back stock, they can't raise dividends. So they had these preferreds where you could buy them and they have a maturity date and they float. If rates move up, they float up. So we've parked a lot of cash there. And then we played the energy space buying. Instead of buying Oxy stock, we bought senior debt, which the debt is the way we play those distressed industries. So that's just to give you a little flavor of, you know, what we're seeing out there. And maybe, Graham, if you have any questions, I can take those now.
Definitely. We can go ahead and jump in here. Looks like first question up, starting right off from the top, as you did in the presentation there. During that conversation with Warren Buffett, what would you say were the key lessons or takeaways that you really took away from it?
Oh, it was great. Well, you know, I asked for books, you know, Phil Fisher's book, you know, Conservative Investors Sleep Well, and then Ben Graham's book, you know, the two chapters. And then actually I called him several times. I didn't really realize who he was, right? And then, you know, like 3 weeks later, the Forbes 400 comes out and he's number three. But then I got names like Lou Simpson, and Lou Simpson was really nice. You know, I flew out to Geico and I met with him. And then there are, you know, I flew around the country, you know, I like Richard Rainwater, and these are names that, a lot of your viewers won't recognize, but you know, Henry Singleton of Teledyne, who's an amazing investor. And so I did that, and then just started, you know, following and going to the meetings, and just the approach is great because it's focused on not losing. What my fear was is I didn't want to blow anyone up. If someone entrusted me with their money, didn't want to lose their money. And this approach is exactly, as you look at the credit, that approach, you look at the 87 crash. I mean, his philosophy has saved so many. And Berkshire, you can just see, in having the independence of thought. And it was funny because I was asking him, because I was going to try to go to Columbia to get an MBA, and he said no. He literally said, do not do that. Get as far away from Wall Street. In fact, he said you're better off to go on to move on to a farm. So actually, that's what I did. But you know, the thing is, you know, you have to think for yourself. And I also asked him about, you know, and he kept talking about accounting, you know, like what's the best thing to get. And he thought getting accounting was more important or as equal to an MBA, you know, because he would say that accounting was the language of business. But you guys kind of already know that. But back then it was, you know, it was amazing because, you know, the Dow was 880, and you know, 10-year bond was 15%, and they're a little different environment. But I think that the number one thing is compound knowledge more than anything, because like you say, the compounding effect of knowledge, and then don't quit. You know, like even Bob Pamplin told me, he said, you know, develop your talent so you can help others, but you know, keep developing that knowledge. Don't quit, but that's the one thing that's amazing. The voracious, both Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett are just voracious learning machines, which is really, really fun.
For sure. And moving on, do you have any suggestions for setting up your own fund, and what do you think you really need to succeed on that front?
Well, the reason I set our fund up, I got tired. You know, you open your 401k statement, or you open your, you know, and there's all these funds, you don't know what's in there. And back with Smith Barney about Citigroup, see, they wanted me to put half my, not net worth, but half my earnings in Citigroup stock. And I asked Jamie Dimon, I said, well, if you'll sign a 10-year contract, I'll do it for 10 years. But he wouldn't. He left. And then Citigroup dropped from like 500 to 45. But I rolled everything into the fund. And the main reason is I wanted something, you know, I priced the fund by hand every day. So I wasn't really in it to like grow a fund company. It was more like I knew we could outperform because in the 80s, you know, we really crushed it. In fact, we have numbers going back to 89 audited, but it's like, you know, Buffett says risk is not knowing what you're in or doing. Most people don't know what they're in or doing. They just trust someone. And we, I priced everything in that fund every day. I own a lot of those companies we bought in 1983 that we still own. So now it's so crowded because back then there was nobody in the business. Well, I shouldn't say that, but when I got in the business in 83, there was nobody in the business, hardly. But now you've got all these funds and funds of funds and derivatives. I mean, you don't have that many. You know, we go through 1,500 companies a year. I mean, we cover a lot of companies, but you got derivatives on top of derivatives, and you've got triple leveraged ETFs, and you've got, you know, Robinhood traders free. But, you know, there's a whole idea of, you know, the problem is everyone equates, you know, just because it's free and you don't know what you're doing, they think that's low cost. But, you know, what we've seen is the markets can be flat from 1900 to 1920. I think the market went up less than 15%. As you know, 1964 to 81, the Dow went up 1 point. So, you know, like I say, it's knowing what you own. And that was my reason for the fund. It's like people trusted me. It wasn't to grow it really big because, you know, if you compound, you know, I was fine back then just with my retirement. So now we've continued to compound. Like I say, the equities in there are up 600%. But our focus is on research, and it's really tough. I don't know if I would set up a fund now. I think now our separate account side, people want to know more of what's going on. And we've operated, like I say, I was on that first board with Jamie Dimon, the first separate account in the nation. And we said, how do we protect, like, you know, a 65-year-old widow? Total transparency. And so we've been operating under transparency. But I think you're better off to the pools, I think, are overdone. There's too many pools. And they're fine on the way up. But once late 60s, everything was pooled up. And then the 70s, everything crashed. And everyone, they bring their money closer in. So now's not the greatest time to set up. Too many. There's just too many. No one really can differentiate. And you can't really tell. That's my advice. Like, if you want to put all your money in a fund and then use that we use it also for clients who need, you know, they're not going to buy like a CAE or some, you know, like a First Service. Those are too small, but if they have the fund, they get the benefit of that, you know.
Gotcha. And what would you say your investment view on Bristol Myers Squibb is right now?
Funny thing, that's been our biggest buy, you know, the last probably 3 or 4 weeks. But yeah, we watch, and we have a lot of Merck. You know, the whole cancer, cures for cancer coming through the immune system. You know, we just like that whole approach where we're, you know, the T cells and, you know, the immune system, just, it's a lot better than chemo. And, you know, they're really cheap. You know, they're, you know, on non-GAAP earnings, I think they're, you know, over $6. So it's, I think, one of the cheaper. We have Abby was really cheap. You know, same thing, they're coming off of Humira. They're losing their Humira patent. But Yeah, we found, you know, Pfizer at 31. Those are some of the buys. I mean, and it was kind of funny that Buffett has been buying. He's been buying AbbVie. We've been buying. He's buying Bristol. They're buying Biogen. And so, no, I think Bristol is in the 50s. We've been buying that in the 50s. But it's got a lot of good pipeline, a real strong pipeline, and they have a lot of debt, but again, there's a lot of free cash flow, but we'd rather have the free cash flow and deal with the headlines. The negative headlines in healthcare, they've always been around, but we've, like I said, United Health has gone from, we bought it what, 40, 43, I think, or it's, over 300. So we're used to negative headlines. We'd rather have negative headlines and strong cash flow than a great story with no cash, But I would say Bristol's for any age client would be good.
Definitely. And on that note of cash flow, would you say that or any other metrics really stand out to you when looking at companies as an indicator of a truly solid company? Is there any kind of metric that you prefer to look at, in a sense?
Good question, Graham. Actually, what I've learned over the years is you have to look at everything, because I've seen these different models, low PE, low price to book. But, we're in a digital age. There's a lot of intangibles. You just have to look at integrity of management. I remember back the firm I was with, Jim Senegal of Costco, he was on the tarmac with a guy named Fred Paulson. Fred was with our firm, and Jim Senegal was writing his business plan, and he said, well, all I promise is we're going to mark up, we'll only mark up 14% and I'll visit all the stores, but that was like, you could have bought Jim Senegal, right? You didn't really need to look at anything else. He came from Price Club, but there's a big weight we put on, you can see the founders, and families, that care about the business, not about money. A lot of top execs are in it for the stock option. So, but we look at, the compensation, we look at, integrity. You can't endure without high integrity. But we also look at, the balance sheet. We look at how much capital does the business, consume. And we just have always been generally in capital light models, So you want to look at that model. Is it enduring? Like the delivery model, I just like, all the, this DoorDash, I'm going like, we've been delivering bags for 15 years, like at no profit, great sales, right? Farming, if we can't get our hazelnuts or our wheat or our cattle, we can't get those to the water, we're dead, right? So the idea that you can deliver all this, the Amazon model, they've done phenomenally well, but that delivery model, transportation costs, we look at everything. We just look at how good is, like, we go back to that See's Candy model. It's like, why is Altria outperformed Apple, since 1986, because there's no CapEx, right? A little bit of pricing every year. So that's what we're looking, not only the model, the integrity of the management, just look what happened to Oxy Petroleum, that CEO. She was paying $51,000 an acre for oil properties. We had clients that had bought for $800 an acre, So overpaying, overborrowing, managements, that can destroy, really fast. You can just see for years Microsoft was overpaying and overborrowing, and really destroying shareholder value. So it all changes, but, we what they have learned is you can't put it in a model. There used to be a fund called the Z7 fund, and they had seven criteria, and they only bought after the seven criteria, and the fund got overweight in tech and blew up. So we've learned you've got to check everything, the balance sheet, the margins, the competitors, and if you can, talk to the CEOs and CFOs, and like that first service, here's property management thing, like how boring the stock goes from like two to over 130, and 16 years or whatever, but that's what we're looking at, the models, Monster Beverage up 70,000% since 2000, so you just have to have the humility to keep digging and checking. And So that's right. The one thing I'd learned is everyone wants to put everything in a box, like the mutual fund industry, you're in a box. It's like, get out of the box and don't rely on formulas. There's no easy way. I mean, we got people out of Enron because we looked. Enron was the cover of Fortune Best Practices. Every major firm had a buy on that thing at 80, and we looked at the balance sheet. It was a disaster. So we sold it, and it was I'm no great genius, but it's like I had the humility to do the homework, and to keep digging and not stop digging because those are things I've learned just the hard way over. I learned in 1985, you get burned a couple of times by analysts, do your own homework, see it with your own eyes, just don't. I've been to 5 states with Ponzi's and, people, and, they trust so much. Like with your money, don't trust, trust, like we say, 1% verified, 99%. But the game is research. The game is knowing accounting, knowing the language of business, and then being incredibly dedicated on, the average reader can read maybe 300 to 400 words a minute, or fastest talkers, 70 words a minute, slowest readers, maybe, 300 to 400 words a minute. So get your data reading as well.
Definitely. So we've talked a lot about buying at this point, and you brought it up briefly there, but where do you hit a point where you sell a company?
Well, if we're in a bubble, we always say you rent a lot of these tech stocks. Back in 2000, we had Nokia prior. It became, obviously the phone company, but we bought it before it was even a phone company. So it went from, two all the way to 50. Well, we knew that we were in, we had this tech telecom media. When we deregulated, anytime you see a deregulation, be ready to sell, right? We deregulated telecom in late 96, 97. All these entrants, Lucent dropped from Lucent was the blue chip out of AT&T, dropped 99% or whatever, over 90% anyway. But so Nokia, it went up. We sold it 40, 42, 44. You scale out. It dropped from 50 back down to 7 or 8. Microsoft bought them. I think it wrote off like 90% of the price, as I recall. So, and that's the thing. If people overpay and overborrow, it just depends. You have to know that business. But we've found my mistakes for sure have been selling, like why we sold any Jim Senegal, Costco. Look at Jeff Bezos. Look at these founders, So you have to see if there's a heart and soul there. And you've got to keep just checking, doing your homework, checking the numbers. But if there's no cash flow there and the prices are up, those are what we call rentals. They're okay, but keep taking it off. And we scale out. Generally, if we get way above cash flow, we'll take off. Good example, Waste Management, we bought that in 1983 at 9x earnings. It was actually growing over 18% a year. We sold it in 1989 at 40x earnings. That stock didn't get above our sell price for, I think, over 12 years. Same with like Intel, a rocket from 94 to 2000. At $75, it was, I think it was up to 50x earnings, I recall. But, look at where Intel, 75 to 50, So you got to be aware of price, value, margins, supply, demand. When you see a deregulation, think supply. When there's a lot of supply coming into the market, that's bad. That's too much. Like dairy is a good example. Where do banks loan the most in farming? Dairy, because the milk comes in every day, right? So you have bankruptcy after bankruptcy. I mean, dairy's been a disaster. We're easy money. When you see easy money in the oil patch, $400 billion in write-downs. It's the worst decline, even in the 30s. The 30s oil dropped from $30 to 3 cents a barrel. But this one has been similar. But, when you have easy money, like Buffett says, grab your wallet and run the other way. But just be aware, everything cycles, and you get right now, insurance is capital constrained, great pricing, hard market, good for Berkshire, but when they suffered under gluts, when you see gluts of supply, and that's when you want to if you see that coming, you need to lighten up,
For sure. And do you have any thoughts on bond yields, or are there any assets you recommend to diversify in with rates being so low?
Yeah, it's amazing. We're, like I say, there's a book called The History of Interest Rates. We're at 5,000 year lows. We have 18 trillion negative. And, you know, it's crazy. It's the most overpriced market. And yet, you know, that's driving a lot of these asset prices. So, like I say, we've been parking, we parked on these short floating rate bank preferreds and what have you, that because banks had to, you know, retain their capital, which made them safer. And so, but then what they do is when they come to maturity, they'll float up or down, you know. So that's, but I, you know, that's just an area we've just, it's amazing that it's destroying savers. And it's helping, you know, obviously speculators. And so, but that area is one you have to really make sure. But there are a lot of dividend stocks out there. You know, we have a lot of companies where, you know, like Abbey was paying over 5%. I mean, you look at some of these Philip Morris, Altair, they're paying, you know, over 6%. And they actually are pretty decent. You know, people want nicotine and they want safe nicotine, which we're finally coming out with safe nicotine. So there are things out there that just because so much of the money is pooled, and it's also algorithm trading, that, you know, a lot of these companies like Bristol, good dividends and decent fundamentals, you know. So like I say, it's like the UK, they're really cheap with this Brexit deal. That market's one of the cheaper. Emerging markets are now starting to come back. So that's why, you know, you need to be on the pulse of these. And but I'd say the biggest bubble out there is the bond bubble. And they're basically telling you they're going to devalue. You know, a dollar back in 1965 is close to, I think, almost $8. That's what the purchasing power. So you know your purchasing power is going down because the governments are telling you we're going to, you know, pay you less than the inflation rate. So what we try to do is buy these really good cash flow businesses, high return businesses, again, for the double, triple play. But there's far better value in a Bristol Myers than a bond, for sure.
Definitely. And do you invest in any pre-earning companies? And if so, how do you value them?
Yeah, like I say, we've done venture deals and we've gone in, you know, like Benchmark did. eBay went from $5 million to $5 billion. And we went in, their second fastest decision was eBags, believe it or not. We were in eBags on the senior with them at the same. But even with that, it turned out okay, but it took over 15 years, you know. So be aware that every one of these that you see, for every big hit, there's so many losers in venture. And it's not the game of, and right now, you know, the market, the market values revenue growth over all other things, and they're not, but that can change. The market can change, and they may value cash flow, you know, next year, or they may. But I think right now, you know, the best performing stocks the last 18 months up until like 8 weeks ago have been money losing biotechs and great stories. And, you know, but that's not our game. We want earnings. I mean, because what happens is, just like in 2000, I mean, these companies, they collapse, you know, there's no earnings. And then the funding has been so generous. But to me, I think it's a venture bubble. And I think that's another bubble that's, you know, when people don't care about price, you know, it's going to change. I mean, at least that's been my experience. You know?
Definitely. And looks like we have a couple questions kind of surrounding the same idea here, being, how has your investment philosophy and strategy evolved over the decades? And have you had to loosen up any of your criteria with the market being really flooded right now?
Yeah, well, that's our problem. We try to be disciplined, but that's hurt us, obviously, in the last few years, because we haven't been willing to pay up, you know, for a lot of these, you know, these platform companies have obviously done well. We have exposure, like I say, Microsoft, but, you know, we're in Microsoft at 20. I mean, we're in, like our biggest holding in the funds, MasterCard, but again, we bought that around 20, and Visa at 15, I think, you know, but, you know, you have to be flexible and yet you can't lose your discipline, because like I say, if you're up 50% year one, you're up 50 in year two, and you're down 50 in year three, you know, steady eight. That's how we beat the markets since 1999. You go like, wow, how did you get markets? You've lagged the last couple of years or whatever, 3 years. And it's because we didn't get killed. I mean, if you go down, that's a long, and you know, a lot of firms, they just merge everything. But we, you know, our outlook's 100 years. So we want to, you know, stay in business. And so we don't mind lagging if things are crazy. But yeah, I mean, you can play the game, but realize, I remember the CEO of Citigroup, Prince, and back in the late 90s, and they interviewed him, you know, they deregulated banking, which that's a disaster, right? So they were saying, well, are you worried? I mean, he says, no. And, you know, in the, you know, I can't remember the exact quote, but, you know, when everyone's partying, I mean, you gotta be in the game, or, you know, you've gotta participate when the parties come. But he, you know, the stock drops from 500 to 45, you know, so we see that over and over in 08. I mean, zero down in mortgages. Well, once you, if you're 20% down in mortgages, you sail through declines. Once there's no skin in the game, and that's what took the financials out in 08, you know, all these, like Lehman was a private partnership that survived the Great Depression. Once they went public, it's other people's money, you know? And so the difference is like, I have all my money in our fund. There's no way I'm going to be, I mean, I don't get greedy, because I know how fast, look at those marijuana stocks dropping 90% in a nanosecond, you know, the last couple of years. So you just, over time, the power of compounding is so phenomenal. If you just keep incrementally compounding, that will wipe, you know, that will beat everything. But the problem is, people, they get greedy in a boom, and then they get concentrated in a boom, and they lose their discipline, and then the boom, you know, crashes, and then they're way behind, you know. I would say discipline has actually hurt us. You know, people, they measure you versus the market, but you know, we've, like I say, we've only had 80% exposed, and our stocks are up 600, but it's kind of like we don't get greedy on things that in bubbles, you know, because they can turn real fast. You know, that in the 87 crash, I mean, we saw over 20% drop in one day. And I would say half the market could drop 80% right now, half of it, because we're going through 1,500 individual companies and easily, you know, and that's the problem. They add Tesla to the market. I mean, right now, are you kidding? It's kind of like, you know, it's like Cisco back in 2000, 2001. I mean, you know, that weight, once it crashes, it's going to take a lot of, in my opinion, you know, the torpedoes are the high expectation. They're overpriced stocks. People ignore their discipline, and then they come back and they wonder why, you know, they got killed. Just my opinion, of course, but.
For sure. And as we're getting to the end of our time here, what I think is a good question for us to end on here, and the last question we've received so far, for a young investor who is trying to define their own investment style, make it more their own versus trying to intimidate or to imitate others, what advice would you give to that young investor to kind of create their own strategy?
Yeah, that's the thing. I wouldn't follow people. I would get in the habit of, like I say, being a voracious learning machine. I'd, you know, study great operators, business operators, you know, study. That's what I did. I studied. I wanted to, in fact, we built a client base of great operators, you know, selfishly, because I love to work for them, you know. So you want to just identify really good businesses, high ethics. And yeah, the biggest trouble, you know, the mistakes I've seen is, you know, listening, you know, do your own homework, see it with your own eyes, build your, in fact, that's what Warren Buffett said. He said, go on a farm, and he said, start from A and go to Z. I mean, that's what he said. It was kind of like, it wasn't like, hey, you know, it was more like you got to build your own cumulative, you know, the knowledge base. So then you're ready, you know, because a lot of these companies we follow for, you know, 5 or 10 years before we buy. And, that's the approach, and treat it with a 100-year outlook. You know, don't, I mean, everyone's trading in five. You know, the big benefit, if you can hold, you know, these companies, but you got to do the homework yourself. I mean, we had some Precision Buffett bought Berkshire bought them for, I think, $234, but we had some clients that had that, you know, under $2, you know, but that's because we that management was great. We knew the business. We didn't listen, you know, but in our field, it's kind of like, I mean, people trade these ETFs, they trade, they don't know what they're in, they switch over, but we'd rather know. And so when you're young, the thing is, I mean, I can tell you that is a huge advantage if you're young, but don't waste it by speculating. Like I always say, you know, we do 95% research and 5% or less trading around, you know, like you want to know. The last option I wrote was 1983. We sold a call on Phillips Petroleum. It was a 45 call. The stock got bought at 90. Clients are going like, how come I'm only getting 45? I was like, because someone wrote a call that was, you know, so that was the last option. But my advice is become a great business analyst, in study who, you know, who is delivering, their, under promising, over delivering, high integrity, build that database. Because a market, like you say, Buffett says, fear, greed, and folly. You know, when folly takes place, that's when you, the odds are the greatest. So, but it's more like, again, cumulative knowledge, focus on the research. Don't be looking at the ticks. Keep your emotion, like Peter Lynch says, keep your emotion, you know, the stomach's the key organ. Keep your emotion out of it, stay rational. But like I say, when you're young, I owe so much to Mr. Buffett just because that focus on research is really in seeing things with your own eyes. And unfortunately, don't trust, you know, but verify. You know.
Definitely. Well, for those of you out in the audience, if you want to tune back in to any part of this presentation, a full recording will be available here on our YouTube channel shortly once we finish up, as well as on GuruFocus.com. As always, we thank you for coming out and giving all the great questions, and we know Jeff really appreciates taking the time to come out here and speak with all of you. So thank you, Jeff from Guru Focus, for joining us today. It was a great presentation, and we do really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You guys do a great job. Your service is great.
Absolutely. So for all of you out in the audience, and to you as well, Jeff, we hope you all stay safe out there and have a happy holidays. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on GuruFocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of GuruFocus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.